So it is not a name that is much remembered these days. But early in the last century, there was a psychologist named John Watson. And he used to say, being a behavioral psychologist, that is, someone who believed that he could train by a system of rewards and punishments the way that people work, he used to say that if you give me a child up to age 5, I can make him what I want for the rest of his life. One can only hope John Watson didn't have any children, because you can imagine what growing up in that house must have been like, pushing buttons and getting pellets and so on. But that idea that a human being works according to laws that you can actually write, systematize, and use to control is, we recognize at its base, a sort of totalitarian idea. That's what regimes do, who try to get their populations to behave in a certain way. But at the same time, it is an idea that human beings work along certain channels or can be channeled to work along certain channels that also lies at the heart of every system of law. It certainly exists in the Jewish tradition. After all, when someone passes away, for 7 days, you're supposed to sit Shiva. And if you say, it doesn't really speak to me, or that's not how I choose to do it, the legal system says, we don't really care. We're sorry that it doesn't speak to you, but actually, going through this experience is important for you and good for you, even if you don't think so. And in that, who cannot hear the echo of their parent's voice saying, I don't care if you don't want to drink your milk or brush your teeth or go to sleep now or go to school or do any of the other millions of things that children have to do because their parents presumably know better. And that is intended to reflect the tradition's knowledge of the way human beings work. Even, by the way, things about human beings that we don't like, that we feel uncomfortable with. Let me tell you a little known but fascinating insight into this side of Jewish law. When someone dies, there is a formula one is supposed to say when you hear the news, Baruch Dayan Emet, blessed be the righteous judge. It's a way of accepting God's verdict in the world that this person has died. Now, what happens if you hear that someone close to you has died and you know that that person in their will has left you a lot of money? Do you have mixed feelings? We don't like to admit to that, right? That's uncomfortable. But actually, according to Jewish law, you are supposed to first say a blessing of thanks and then say Baruch Dayan Emet. Why? Because once you acknowledge the part of you, however small it is, and I'm sure in people here it would be infinitesimal, that might be happy that you're about to be monumentally enriched, then you can actually be truly sad. This is one of those cases where the tradition says, I know how you work better than you do. Say this blessing first. And even though you might protest against it inside yourself, you would never choose to say that blessing, because who would want to admit that about themselves? The tradition doesn't give you a choice. I bring this up because Judaism is, after all, a very serious legal tradition in lots of ways. And yet, when we prayed a couple of days ago from the Mahzor, we didn't read legislation. At the key moment of the Jewish year, we didn't talk about law. What we read in the prayer book was poetry. It was beauty. It was all about inexpressible things, not legislatable things. And this idea that what is at the heart of even a legal tradition is poetry is beautifully illustrated this morning by the man who can't speak. Remember, Moses begins his career by saying to God, Lo ish devarim anochi. I'm not a man of words. You don't want me. I don't know how to talk. Send somebody else. Let Aaron be the spokesman, because me, I don't know how to speak. And now, at the end of Moses' life, as he's leaving the children of Israel, what does he do? He doesn't only speak, he sings. Remember that in Hebrew, the word for song and the word for poetry are the same word, shir. And this is Shirat Moshe, the song of Moses. Why does he sing at the end of his life, this man who doesn't know how to talk? This man who, by the way, more than anyone else in the Bible is associated with law. The best way to explain it is to take a step back and ask yourself, who is the most important figure in Jewish history, along with Moses? I won't make you call it out, because I don't want to say no, wrong. I want to get the answer I want to get. Who's the most important figure in Jewish history other than Moses? Obviously, King David. He's the ancestor of the Messiah. And what was David? He was a king. He was a warrior. He was a sinner. He was a lover. He was a poet. The Psalms are from David. And there is something powerful, poignant, and very, very important about the idea that the Jewish tradition chose as its two central figures two poets. Remember that Moses' song begins first at the sea and ends at the end of the Torah. Why poetry? I think it has something to do with the fact that the central experiences of life, the central emotional experiences, the central affective experiences, are things that you cannot perfectly describe. I mean, think about it. I have this experience all the time. When couples come to me because they want to be married, I'll say to them, what do you love about the other person? And yes, sometimes they will list characteristics. It's nice, kind, has a good heart. But if you push long enough, they say, I love him because I love him. In other words, they end up in poetry. Because the central experiences of our lives have to be explained in metaphor, in imagery. I was in the Torah in the Round service a little earlier, and Rabbi Hirsch was talking about how God is referred to as a rock. What does it mean that God is a rock? How can you understand that? The idea is not that God is round and hard and lifeless. But we know what that means. The imagery speaks to us the solidity, the security, the eternity of a rock. And there's something about the poetry that speaks more deeply than any description could possibly do. T.S. Eliot was once giving a lecture, and a woman got up and said to him, Mr. Eliot, you wrote In one of your poems, "Lady, three white leopards sat under the juniper tree in the cool of the day." What did you mean by that? And Eliot said, "What I meant by that was, lady, three white leopards sat under the juniper tree in the cool of the day." In other words, the point about poetry is that it can't be reduced to something else. When you hear a poem and someone says, "What does it mean?" if you paraphrase it, you violate the poetry. And it's not only true, by the way, that poetry, we tend to have this very romanticized view that poetry is all about beautiful hills and mountains and trees. And there's a story about Robert Frost, the great American poet, that he was once sitting at dinner with someone, and they said, "Oh, Mr. Frost, look out the window. There's a beautiful sunset." And he said, "I never talk business at dinner." But it isn't true that poetry is only about sunsets and babbling brooks. It's about that which can't be described in other words. Laughter is a kind of poetry. There are certain looks that are exchanged between people that have poetry in them. There is a beauty, a beating heart, at the center of the Jewish tradition that precedes the law, that comes before the ritual, without which all the law and the ritual and the prayer would be cold and ashen and dead. That's why Moses burst out into song. That's why David is a poet. That's why when we sit on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Shabbat and Sukkot and every other time of the year with the prayer book in front of us, we're not reading a casebook. We're reading a collection of poems. God can never be described, but every poem, if a true poem, is in some sense a poem about God. Perhaps the best way to summarize it is poetry. Remember what Yeats wrote about aged men is true of all of us, that we are but tattered coats upon a stick, unless the soul clap its hands and sing. That's what the tradition is about. Souls clapping their hands and singing, realizing that the words of the poet Shelley are true, that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world because they're the ones who give us our eyes. The psalmist, Moses, even the poets of today. And so I hope that in this new year, our souls will clap their hands and sing, and we will have a year of poetry, of joy, of song, of love, and of peace. Amen.